He'd play like the Gibson girl, which was an ideal type created by Charles Dana Gibson, who's the illustrator. He'd play Salome, which in 1908, 1909 was this really popular biblical character. He'd do the college girl. He'd do the old time Victorian lady, the Lillian Russell. He's also a quick change artist, right? Which audiences love.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Well, here I am back in Hollywood making my first talking picture.
And I thought, both from a psychological, sociological, and historical standpoint, here's a fascinating person.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Tonga's government takes heat for appointing an openly gay High Court Chief Justice. Iran chastises Australia's ambassador for posting purple. And long before RuPaul, there was beautiful Julian Elting. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Elena Botkin-Levy.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 7th, 2024. The appointment of a gay man to be Lord Chief Justice of its Supreme Court has the Polynesian island of Tonga embroiled in controversy. Opposition kicked in just 3 days after Malcolm Bishop took office on September 2nd, when the Tonga Law Society petitioned King Tupou VI and his Privy Council, calling for Bishop's ouster. Tongan law punishes gay male and heterosexual sodomy with up to 10 years in prison. The petition charges that as a gay man, King's Council of Wales bishop would not be able to rule impartially on any challenge to those laws. Bishop's 51-year relationship with his late partner Anthony van der Waard was widely reported when van der Waard was killed in a 2019 robbery. The 79-year-old bishop's biography includes theology studies at Oxford University, according to the local news outlet, Kaniva Tonga. He recently published The Gospels, a lawyer's translation from the original Greek, and his translation of the entire New Testament is scheduled for publication by the end of this year. That has not stopped Christian church groups from strongly opposing his appointment. They might organize marches in protest and could also file separate petitions demanding Bishop's removal. Former president of Tonga's queer advocacy Laitis Association, Henry Aho, challenged unfounded questions about Bishop's impartiality. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's Pacific Beat, "I think these objections are themselves objectionable. I think they're inflammatory, insensitive to the Tongan Laiti community, and insulting, not only to the Chief Justice, but also to all members of Tonga's Law Society who have diverse sexual orientations. Every Tongan citizen has the right to petition the King and Privy Council over any issue, but the government is not obligated to act on them."
Iran's government has summoned Australian Ambassador Ian McConville for supporting queer youth. The embassy in Tehran posted photos on Instagram from its celebration of Australia's Wear It Purple Day on September 1st. Iran's foreign ministry claimed the posts promoted homosexuality and called them insulting and contrary to Iranian and Islamic traditions, customs, and culture, according to the state-run IRNA News. Same-gender sex is a criminal offense in Iran. Men can be punished by death, and women face up to 100 lashes in the public square. McConville replied that the post depicted an internal event with no references to Iran. The three photos were captioned, "Today and every day, we're dedicated to creating a supportive environment where everyone, especially LGBTQIA+ youth, can feel proud to be themselves." Australia's Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations, Murray Watt, defended the ambassador. Watt did not say if Australia would take any official action in response to McConville being called on the carpet.
Six major U.S. publishers are suing the state of Florida. They're saying that the state's 2023 law that lets anyone have a book removed from a school library if it describes sexual content is unconstitutional. The plaintiffs are HarperCollins, Penguin Random House, Hachette Book Group, Macmillan Publishers, Simon & Schuster, and Sourcebooks. Several authors, two students, and two parents have joined them. Hundreds of books have been removed from public school libraries across the state since Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed House Bill 1069 into law last year. HarperCollins' press release this week says that books by Maya Angelou, Aldous Huxley, Judy Blume, and Charles Dickens have been yanked from library shelves. Well-known works by Ernest Hemingway, Alice Walker, Leo Tolstoy, Stephen King, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and Kurt Vonnegut have also vanished. Florida Department of Education spokesperson Nathalia Medina insists, "There are no books banned in Florida." She says, "Sexually explicit material and instruction are not suitable for schools." Just what constitutes pornographic or sexual content? The lawsuit claims that many of the removed books are not remotely obscene and challenges the legislation's vague definitions. It argues that students have the First Amendment free speech right to read constitutionally protected books, free from unconstitutional content-based restrictions, mandated by the state of Florida.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is slapping an asterisk on its transgender members. An updated handbook for the church, popularly known as the Mormons, specifies that trans people cannot become clergy, teachers, or work with children. Trans people who have transitioned socially or medically cannot be baptized. According to the update released in late August, church leaders counsel against pursuing surgical, medical, or social transition away from one's biological sex at birth. Leaders advise that taking these actions will result in some church membership restrictions. A trans Mormon's membership record will now be annotated, as it would be for other so-called situations, such as incest, child pornography or abuse, plural marriage, or embezzlement of church funds. Nevertheless, the handbook says transgender people should be treated with sensitivity, kindness, compassion, and Christ-like love. It's not entirely clear why the church decided to issue such harsh new restrictions on them now. The over 45-year-old queer Mormon group Affirmation decried the policy changes, but refuses to give up hope. Relying on the Mormon article of faith that God will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God, they wrote, "We hope that God will yet reveal better for our transgender siblings."
Finally, Sweetbriar College in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia has a thorny problem with its admissions policy. The college's website now says, "An applicant is qualified for admission if she confirms that her sex assigned at birth is female and that she consistently lives and identifies as a woman." However, that's a new interpretation of Sweetbriar's founding document. The school was created by the will of Indiana Fletcher Williams, who died in 1900. Williams wanted the college on her former plantation estate to be for the education of white girls and young women. Only the Civil Rights Act of 1964 persuaded the school to admit black female students, according to the Associated Press. Today, Sweetbriar President Mary Pope Hudson says that the phrase "girls and women" must still be interpreted as it was understood at the time the will was written, to avoid a slippery slope toward coeducation. That decision will make it one of the few women's colleges in the United States to specifically ban transgender applicants. The Faculty Senate voted 48-4 this week, with one abstention, to ask the college's board of directors to rescind the new policy. Senate Chair and English professor John Gregory Brown called it absurd and morally repugnant. One board member has resigned over it. A statement from the Student Government Association says the policy is alienating, unnecessary, and reflects the rise of transphobia in our country. Non-binary senior Isabella Paul is the student government president. They told the Associated Press that more than 10% of the school's 460 students currently use different pronouns and would not conform to Sweetbriar's new definition of woman. What of them? Hudson replied only that the school tries to ensure that all of our students feel welcome on campus.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending September 7th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V. Stay healthy.
And I'm Elena Botkin-Levy. Stay safe.
You deserve a president who respects you, talks to you, and who levels with you, puts it right on the level, and who always has your best interests and has your back. I have your back, I have your heart, and I have every other part of your body.
JD is not weird. He's a solid rock. I happen to be a very solid rock.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
I think that drag shows were a recent invention to hear some folks talk. Nothing could be further from the truth. For a history and fashion lesson, This Way Out's David Hunt travels back to the early days of the last century with Andrew Erdman, author of Beautiful, the story of Julian Elting, America's greatest female impersonator.
Conservatives in the United States have mobilized a knockdown, drag-out fight against, well, drag. They've put cross-dressing in the crosshairs, passing laws aimed at outlawing or at least restricting drag shows in states like Tennessee, Montana, Florida, and Texas. But drag hasn't always been a lightning rod for controversy. I'm David Hunt. In the early years of the 20th century, one of the most popular and highest paid entertainers in the United States was a female impersonator, as drag performers were known back then. His name was William Julian Dalton, but he went by the stage name Julian Elting. The foremost expert on Elting is scholar and historian Andrew L. Erdman. His new book, published by Oxford University Press, is titled Beautiful, the story of Julian Elting, America's greatest female impersonator. Erdman joined me for a conversation about the popular drag artist who got his start in vaudeville. If I could go back in time and see Julian Elting on the bill at the Orpheum Theater, what would I see? What would his performance be like?
You'd see about 12 to 15 minutes of this very beautiful and precisely made up, very detailed woman, different personizations or different characterizations, I should say, of women. So he'd play like the Gibson girl, which was an ideal type created by Charles Dana Gibson, who was the illustrator. He'd play Salome, which in 1908, 1909 was this really popular biblical character. He'd do the vamp, the vampire girl, the bathing beauty. He'd do the college girl. He'd do the old time Victorian lady, the Lillian Russell. all of these. So he's also a quick change artist, right? Which audiences love. And you'd see one after the other. You'd also see a guy or a woman who really knew how to sing and dance and had great rapport with the audience, and just down to his finest details, knew how to hold and carry himself in all of these personifications. And then at the end, you'd see somebody who stepped to the edge of the stage and pulled off his wig and was, you know, maybe stuck a cigar in his mouth, and all of a sudden became Dude, you know, and he would say thank you, and the audience would go crazy, and you'd get all of that rush of excitement. I mean, it was you can tell it was a real thrill. That was really his magic.
Did families come to the shows? Would there be children in the audience?
Vaudeville was just a variety show. All sorts of different acts strung together for an hour or two, usually a pretty reasonable price. There were different flavors of vaudeville. But Julian Elting was really popular in what's called big time vaudeville. That was these were arranged in circuits, much like, you know, movie chains are in circuits. The Keith Albee circuit was really the biggest of them. But there were others, the Orpheum circuit, the Pantages circuit. And they were absolutely oriented towards a family audience. There were afternoon shows. They really wanted to get women and children in. They would place vaudeville theaters near like shopping districts. It seems that they struggled to get as many women and children in to see shows as they wanted, but still the appeal was entire, and it was supposed to be very free from suggestion and free from sexuality. The truth was often otherwise, but that's how it kind of presented itself, sort of a very sanitized, in an earlier age, perhaps Disney-fied sort of entertainment. So absolutely, it was meant for all members of the family.
Looking back, gender roles were so distinct in the early 1900s. And I feel like there may have been some mystery, especially for young men, around the so-called feminine mystique. Was that something that Elting was able to play on?
That's a really good point, and I hadn't thought about it that way. But I think for sure you have this notion of the dual spheres. You have the woman's sphere, which is domestic and private and soothing, and then the male sphere, which is ambitious and competitive and public. And yet there is also, I think what Julian Elting does, like you're saying, gave people and men in particular a way to kind of poke through and somehow deal with that massive and very bewildering apparent difference, this essential difference, and wondering if it was so essential after all. And part of what Julian was able to do is to, at the same time, say, men and women are very different, and I can play them both. You know, I can play them both perfectly. I'm not a transgressor here. So it's kind of mind-bending.
His act worked on one level because he demonstrated the correct way to, as we would say today, perform female gender roles.
Well, yeah, I mean, almost nothing says gender more, the performativity of gender more than Julian Elting, who at the very same time reinforced the idea of the essentialness of gender, kind of the illusion of it. It's interesting. What I think he begins to make clear unintentionally is just how performed gender is.
Because if the most beautiful woman on the stage is a man, what does that say about gender?
Yeah, it says kind of that, and this is pretty apparent, that being a woman is a job. It's a task one must continually attend to kind of rise up to full womanliness. He does it. He does it twice a day. And he even sells products for women to help them do it. And there's this idea that women are constantly failing to be women as perfectly as he succeeds at being a woman. I mean, it's pretty funny in a way.
How did he present himself when he was not performing, when he was off stage?
Certainly when in public or around journalists, as a very kind of hetero-coded straight man who was, when he wasn't in heels, he didn't like being in heels. He liked wearing business suits and riding horses and boxing. There's endless pictures of him boxing and talking about boxing. He liked to, you know, and some of this is true. I think he did really like to spend time on the land, kind of working the land. He owned various estates. He was a hard drinker. He liked fishing. He liked carousing, gambling. He claimed to know a lot about business. I think he did and he didn't. But he was just a sort of like just an ordinary young man. And the press and the media wanted to see him that way rather than as this kind of gender rebel. So they were happy to promote that. Some have said that he did male drag as well as he did female drag.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. Let's listen to a movie trailer from 1929 that features one of Hollywood's biggest stars, Julian Elting.
Pardon me, Mr. Elting. Would you speak a few words over this station?
Gladly.
Thank you.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Well, here I am back in Hollywood making my first talking picture. I have had several ladies on the set and ladies around the different studios ask me this year as to who is making my costumes. I suppose that today Hollywood leads the world in the making of gown creations. You see, we have so many marvelous movie stars who need so many clothes and costumes that has brought all the finest designers from all parts of the world to Hollywood.
Now, back to my conversation with scholar and historian Andy Erdman, author of Beautiful, the story of Julian Elting, America's greatest female impersonator. Tell me more about Elting's career in Hollywood, where he got his first starring role in a silent movie, The Countess Charming, in 1917.
Yeah, so after vaudeville, Julian Elting goes on to be in these bespoke musical comedies that are written for him, where he plays a young guy who very much a sort of Julian Elting character who likes just smoking and gambling and looking at the ladies. And then all of a sudden he must dress up as a countess or a widow or something, which he does beautifully and perfectly. And then there's all these erotic shenanigans. And then he ends up getting the girl and finding the diamonds or whatever. And those are very successful. I think he gets tired of it and becomes formulaic and he wants to go make movies. And his movies are actually successful at first. He makes three movies that are very successful. They're sort of like 50, 60 minute comedies. I think that they fit in well enough to what Hollywood is making at the time in sort of mainstream silent movie fare. And then he has a movie that has to be pulled with the end of World War I. It's a World War I themed movie, and it has to be pulled because audiences don't want to see war themed stuff anymore. And, you know, much like today, the vagaries of the market can kind of very quickly, this is what he discovered, can destroy a movie actor's career. And now he's getting older too. And movies are able to do more in terms of their illusionism. So he kind of goes from being a very singular kind of performer at the top of a trade to just kind of another comic silent film actor. And it's not really what he's built for. You know, he's able, in a way, he's more successful than other vaudevillians who make the transition. But his run is a decent one, but it ends kind of abruptly.
In the 1920s and 30s, society's views of gender and sexuality began to change. How did that impact Elting's career?
In the 20s, you start to have the decline of vaudeville popularity and the rise of nightclub and speakeasy culture, lounge culture. Julian Elting also starts to become more interested in creating this artist's colony and this kind of spa retreat center down in San Diego County. So he's playing smaller venues, kind of trying to raise money to keep himself afloat. There's not the same money in vaudeville. He's not making movies. He goes into debt. He goes on tour. He makes more money. Towards the end of the 20s, you know, the 20s is an era of relative liberality, but of course, forces of reaction, kind of like in the 1970s, are starting to kind of stir up. They don't like all this freedom. And then in the late 20s, particularly around the trials of Mae West, and she wrote these plays that were very provocative and showed the sexual underworld and the gay underworld, and a lot of cross-dressing. And so it starts to fall into disfavor. And then, of course, in the 30s, with everything that's happening with the economy and politics, there's a real fear cast over America. And, you know, what happens in times of fear? The seeming cultural transgressors are targeted rather than the actual problems. This is my view. And so, yeah, Elting is always held in higher regard because he's always more of a gender conformer in his weird way. And he doesn't want to raise a stink. He's a little bit libertarian in his views. So he's one of the last ones that's kind of called on the carpet. And he eventually has his kind of day in court. But the whole cultural attitude of liberality and acceptance collapses and turns into a kind of reactionary fist.
Finally, why personally did you decide to focus on Julian Elting?
I came across Julian when I was writing my last book about another kind of great forgotten artist, Eva Tangwe, who was another kind of, in her own way, gender rebel and big star in vaudeville. They knew each other. They had this kind of sham engagement together that played out in the press. And I came across Julian, and I thought, both from a psychological, sociological, and historical standpoint, here's a fascinating person. And it really hits that time period, both from intellectual history and just kind of pop culture history that I love. I'm always drawn back to sort of, I don't know, New York and kind of the entertainment world of like 1890 to 1930. It's just fascinating to me. And I kind of dove in, and there's been so much speculation about Julian, but there was never a thorough book about him. And boy, there was a lot of good, I had to dig a lot, but there's a lot of good stuff out there. And I like to tell stories. And so this seemed like a good one to tell, particularly given the time frame that we're in. So
I'd like to thank my guest, scholar and historian Andy Erdman, author of Beautiful, the story of Julian Elting, America's greatest female impersonator. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Where's the magic gone? Where did it run to? Never thought it'd leave, but I'm left with an emptiness. Won't you tell me where the magic's gone? Well, back when I was young, it was all around. Everywhere I looked, it was there. Now I blankly stand and I wonder where the magic's gone.
They called her the last of the Red Hot Mamas.
She was a prolific singer. She had an enormous long 6-decade career. And over those 6 decades, she said that she sang thousands and thousands of songs.
You're gonna miss me, honey, when I'm far away.
Don't miss a tribute to the late, great Sophie Tucker by writer-performer Laurel Mead. She'll talk about her show, Ms. Tucker Will See You Now, with our Brian DeShazer. Next time on This Way Out. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Elena Bacchalini and John Dyer V, and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt, with audio from The Voice of Hollywood with Kyle Cox. You heard music by Simon & Garfunkel, Billy Joel, the Manhattan Ragtime Orchestra, the Sound Aces, and Sophie Tucker. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Lee Sloan of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors like them make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media. Email us at info@thiswayout.org or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on WRFI, Watkins Glen, New York, 3ECB, Croydon, Victoria, Radio Phoenix Internet Radio, Phoenix, Arizona, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.